Let's go ahead and go to our second video here with Dr. Secord.
Dr. Secord told me about a 68-year-old woman presenting with mismatch repair deficient metastatic disease.
She presented with postmenopausal bleeding, and she's diagnosed with a grade 1 endometrial cancer. She had a pelvic ultrasound that showed a fairly large uterus and a 3x2 centimeter mass on the cervix. On exam, this mass on the cervix seemed to go into the perimetry on the left side. So we ordered a PET CT that showed hypermetabolic activity, not only in the cervix and endometrium, but retroperitoneal adenopathy, right omental nodule, and right-sided pulmonary nodules. So really concerning. So her tumor testing was obtained and she was deficient in mismatch repair, but now obvious metastatic and widespread disease. We initiated carboplatin and paclitaxel with IO therapy. And our plan was to re-image after 3 cycles. I just saw her the other day and she has had a really great response, a strong partial response. And a question I have for the group is, do they have any preference in specific IO therapy? For instance, pembrolizumab, dostarlimab, or durvalumab? Do they think there's a difference in these different types of immunotherapeutic agents? And then in addition, would they treat differently based on the histologic subtype? So if this patient had a carcinosarcoma, would that lend them to more likely use dostarlimab? So you have such an esteemed panel there today, and Dr. Powell is the chair of the uterine committee at NRG. So I'd love to hear a commentary regarding GY018 and the design of this study compared to the RUBY study and DUO-E, and thoughts there in terms of the benefit of one IO therapy over the other and differences between the clinical trial eligibility. And specifically for the whole group, which data set looks stronger for you? And in totality, do you feel like there's a biologic rationale why one IO agent would be preferred over the other?
So leave it to Dr. Secord to ask 100 questions in one. I'm going to actually start with our first question, because I think we all discussed this with PARP inhibitors when they first came out. Dr. Powell, do you think there's a difference between the specific checkpoint inhibitors? And maybe you can break it up PD-1 versus PD-L1 or take them individually.
Yeah, I think, you know, I like your approach on the PD-1 versus PD-L1. You know, when we look at the single agent activity, there does seem to be more activity in the PD-1s over PD-L1 in endometrial cancer. Again, small series, not well controlled, no cross-trial comparison. The only head-to-head trial we have is in lung cancer, where dostarlimab did seem to do slightly better. Well, actually, was statistically better. But we don't have that in endometrial cancer, and I really hesitate on cross-trial comparison. I think the area that she mentioned with carcinosarcoma was included. 10% of the patients within the RUBY trial were carcinosarcoma. Most of those were in the P53 group, but not all, which, again, one of those lessons that not all carcinosarcomas are treated the same. They do seem to, again, we're in the RUBY trial, so I would probably follow the trials and use dostarlimab in that group.
Yeah, and Dr. Backus, same question, but do you see any difference in toxicities as well?
Not so much, honestly. I think dostarlimab, pembrolizumab are probably much more used under durvalumab here. But I think overall, like the schedules are the same now. Obviously, the 6-week scheduling we're now also used to. Certainly, the dostarlimab has a little bit more data in that space for giving every 6-week dosing, but we're doing it across all the different drugs. So schedule doesn't really make a difference. I don't see personally like a ton of difference there. It's hard to predict which patient's going to get the toxicity too.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more preferential to the PD-1 inhibitors. And I think when you look at the studies, you know, we didn't talk about ATTEND trial, which is using atezolizumab, another PD-L1. And the PMMR group really didn't see a difference. And I just feel like the PD-1 may be a little bit more potent. And this is just me speaking on my own, like, beliefs. But I definitely don't see a difference between the PD-1s individually. And I agree, toxicities kind of have been similar.
I think it is still important, though, to think about it, too. Like, the populations were just very different, too. Yeah. Like, the PD-L1 patients, the studies with the PD-L1 patients all had many more Asian patients, as Dr. Powell just pointed out. So is it the PD-L1 or is it the population that we're testing? So it's hard. Like we're never going to see it head to head, but yes.
Great point.
There are differences.
There are differences. And I think you're right about patient population, which I know, Matt, I might go by it between first names and last names, forgive me. Dr. Powell, you spoke a little bit about kind of disparities when you were talking about, you know, higher risk histologies. And speaking of histologies, how do you interpret subtypes? Does that influence your decision on which specific, we'll just stick with dostarlimab and pembrolizumab in the since those are the ones more commonly used. When you have a patient with carcinosarcoma, does that influence your choice? And as the Ruby PI, like I'd love to hear your point, because you did actually intentionally include that in the trial.
Yeah, so it does, you know, again, we would kind of follow the guidance from the trial and use the dostarlimab in that group with carcinosarcoma. As far as subtype, though, you know, a lot of this is just hypothesis generating. You know, it's not perfect. The whole exome sequencing data, as I mentioned, has some holes in it. We do hope to have a more robust translational science coming out with 018. And hopefully, as we put all that information together, we'll learn more, especially when it comes to how do you put HER2 in the mix here? When do you choose to use a HER2 agent versus an immunotherapy mm-hmm. agent?
Yeah, Dr. Backus, anything to add about histology?
You're
pretty consistent with the guidelines.
I agree.
Yeah. And I just want to highlight, you know, Dr. Powell was actually very instrumental in carcinosarcoma work that actually kind of showed it works really kind of like an epithelial cancer and kind of breaking that mentality of a sarcoma. So I think it's really pivotal work, and I think it's important that we do include these histologies as we move forward, but that's just my opinion. Well, we have another video for you featuring Dr. Letterman.
One of the most exciting recent developments in oncology has been the use of immunotherapy in localized MSI-high cancers, including the groundbreaking research from Memorial Sloan Kettering on the use of primary dostarlimab without surgery for rectal cancer. The initial Memorial work had only one patient with endometrial cancer, and when I met with Dr. Letterman, the first thing I queried him about, and also would like to hear about from the faculty, was an upfront trial being conducted at his institution on the use of immunotherapy in localized MSI-high endometrial cancer.
Colleagues in our institute are leading an international study of neoadjuvant IO in patients with endometrial cancer. So two cycles before they actually have surgery to actually look at the biological effect of IO on the endometrium when it comes to surgery. So I think there's a lot of interest in taking this forward. I think there's clearly a hope that one day we may be able to dispense with the chemotherapy, which we know in these often elderly and comorbid patients is quite toxic, carboplatin, paclitaxel. But we need to understand the real activity of these drugs. And I think in that neoadjuvant space is one way of doing that.
Dr. Powell, you mentioned Dominica and C93, which are looking at a single agent checkpoint inhibitor versus carboplatin and paclitaxel. You also kind of mentioned the challenge of it not having the chemo IO arm. But what do you think, if those studies are positive, how would that inform your practice, or how would that change your practice?
I think it's certainly going to depend on the magnitude of benefit is going to be the big issue about, you know, is that population the right one to go without chemotherapy? It's already changed my practice a bit. As patients with DMMR disease start to get bad neuropathy, I'm probably a little quicker to de-escalate their taxane. Those type of things, you know, you'd see that happening because you feel like that immunotherapy is doing the bulk of the work for those patients. I still think, you know, when we look at Ruby, 71% of the patients in the DMMR cohort went on to get, or in the placebo side of the DMMR cohort went on to get immunotherapy, yet there's still a big difference in survival. So single agent IO, at least following chemotherapy, may not be as good. Just a lot of room for debate.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was also, you know, in the study that showed the provocative responses, the endometrial cancers in a larger series, I can't remember where it came from, didn't have as pronounced of a response. You didn't see that 100%. Dr. Backus.
Yeah, so that was a study from the Netherlands, but it was a small group, but they were, yes, I was not involved. But a lot of those patients did not have a complete response. And so there's actually a really interesting post, I'm going to put a plug in here for one of our fellows, Julia Tillith, had a poster, and we have a group of about over 50 patients where we looked at the patients that still had a uterus in place and truly got regimen for metastatic disease, we left the uterus. While they had a beautiful response, oftentimes outside the uterus, in the omentum, in a peritoneum, I'm hearing a lot of discussion, we're going to leave the uterus in place. They had a complete response. But we actually typically in our practice still go back to remove the uterus. And we've had one PMMR patient in the whole group, one PMMR patient, not a DMMR, who had a true complete response. Oh. Everybody else had still residual disease in the uterus. So I don't think we're quite there. And there's something different about the uterine environment, that it's resistant, and who knows, it has to be, at the unique purpose of the uterus probably. But I don't think we're quite ready to just stop doing hysterectomy necessarily if there's a complete response. I would be a little bit careful with that at this time.
Yeah, and I think it was last year at SGO where they presented neoadjuvant or primary immunotherapy in advanced endometrial cancers, and they had some pretty impressive responses. So it was pretty exciting. But I caution, because how do you surveil these patients? Are you still doing endometrial biopsies? What's the rate of recurrence? You know, there's also thoughts of, can we use this for fertility instead of hormones in patients who are DMMR? I think we have a lot to learn. I think it's a really exciting area. And I think Dominica and C93 have some... they will be informative in one way or another.
Can I just make one comment?
Absolutely.
To that effect? So we've entertained three or four concepts over the last 5-6 years on this early stage endometrial cancer, giving IO in the DMMR cohort. You know, as we know, the big challenge we have is deciding who's at high enough risk to warrant the toxicity of giving an adjuvant therapy. Yes, immunotherapy is quite well tolerated, but some people do quite poorly. So balancing that, we don't have good enough imaging to tell us really who those 3C1s are that have small 2-millimeter mets. We don't have a great way of assessing that patient and where that risk-benefit ratio happens. And so you could say, well, you guys have been slow in uptake on this neoadjuvant approach. No, we haven't. We've been working on it greatly, but we really trying to balance toxicity and that we would have with implementing immunotherapy for these patients versus getting a hysterectomy data and then seeing what we have. Now, we have to respond to some other data that is maturing soon, so more to come.
Yeah, and I think Dr. Letterman's trial, they are all getting surgery afterwards, so I think it will also be helpful.
So patients that have, where I've had more successes if the patient has completed immunotherapy and they're off for a while and have another recurrence later on, similar as really with any drug. If you don't progress on the drug, there may be able to an opportunity to restart again. IO after IO, do you combine it? I mean, I know some of this short, smaller studies that add lenvatinib or something like that, but it's probably a combination of something. What is the right combination to do this again, and is it necessary? It's great that we have other opportunities too, that we don't always have to do IO after IO, but we can have all these other ADCs and other different oral agents and other hormonal agents that still may be an opportunity too.
Yeah, great. Dr. Powell, any other thoughts?
The only thing I would point out, when we designed GYO25, which is the ipi-nivo versus nivolumab trial, we deliberately put in a cohort that would have IO after IO, so they could previously had it. Now, unfortunately, it was a 12-month interval from their last IO to the next, but it was the one group that the experts at the NIH said, this is probably the group this IO after IO is going to work in, is a DMMR population. Because it's an evolving tumor, those tumors may look to need re-education with the immune system with further checkpoint. And, you know, we'll talk about it a little bit tomorrow when I present the longer-term RUBY data in the DMMR cohort. It does seem to be that these patients can have small recurrences but still do quite well, even, you know, a year or two after their IO therapy. So I think that definitely is a population. In the PMMR, I know a lot of people are looking at lenvatinib, pembrolizumab, and see responses, and I think, you know, more to come there. Hopefully that will continue to be one of our tools that we can use, but better things are available.
Yeah, and I'll add one thing to that. So it's not really a true IO after IO, but we also see in this situation like a recurrence on IO that it's just an isolated site. All the disease is controlled, but there's a recurrence in one single focus in the lung or one lymph node in the periaortic region or something like that. that's more like a keep somebody on IO, but I'm going to radiate that other target. And so we still, or maybe even remove it, whether it's with surgery, obviously it would be with surgery then, but you can do another intervening strategy and it becomes kind of IO after IO, but you just keep them on with spot treat. And so I think that is a very important
I like that for patients with mixed response too. I'll use that often.
I feel like we've changed the pattern of recurrence a little bit. I mean, anecdotally,
yeah.
where more of these localized therapies are needed.
Yep. Great. Thank you, guys. That was great.